chapter 4. The Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, somebody, verse 2.
Take a census of the Kohathite branch of the Levites by their clans and families.
From 30 years old up to 50 years old. So those were the years of duty in this case. Those who would be dismantling, carrying, and assembling the tabernacle.
We're in Numbers chapter 4, not Leviticus, right?
Yeah, right. Chapter 4.
I was going, wait a minute, I thought we already did this.
You said Leviticus, but we're in Numbers.
Yeah, Numbers.
Yeah. It's habit.
Yeah. From 30 years old up to 50 years old, all who can come on duty to do the work in the tent of meeting. Verse 4.
This is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting, the most holy things.
I'm sorry, we are lacking light here. I didn't raise the blinds before our Bible study. So
he's the only one that can reach them. I'm short. Actually, I can if I climb up on something.
So I was noticing that everything is in shadows.
Yeah, I was thinking that same thing.
Okay, so then in verse 4, the most holy things. And that's why they come listed first. When the camp is to set out, Aaron and his son shall go in and take down the veil of the screen and cover the Ark of the Testimony with it. Verse 6.
Then they are to cover this with hides of sea cows, spread a cloth of solid blue over that, and put the poles in place.
Okay. Now, some of the translations may say goat skins. There's a dispute as to what creature it actually was. The older, more traditional is sea cows, whatever those are. And that makes actually better sense, because by being a creature of the water, it would provide waterproofing over the assembly.
Would a sea cow be a seal or
a walrus?
Or a walrus, isn't something, aren't they called sea cows sometimes?
Manatees are really called sea cows, but that's in our language.
There are some aquous animals that are specific to that area. And if I remember looking into this in the past, references were made in some of the commentaries to those. So
seals and walruses.
Walrus, manatee, whatever. Something on that order that
that's what I heard
is native to that area.
Manatee, I thought they were in the desert.
Yep. But of course, you remember back when we were in the book of Exodus and talking about the people of Israel traveling through the desert area, that was not as desertified as arid as it is now. And there were constant trading caravans that would go through that area.
Oh, okay.
And the people of Israel could trade to acquire those things that they didn't bring with them.
So does the Mediterranean then have seals and walruses and that type of animal?
And the Red Sea.
Oh, okay.
Both in the Gulf of Suez and in the Gulf of Aqaba. And that whole area would be utilized for acquiring things carrying them around, trading them, making profit in that way. Remember the Midianites going through the area. And they were willing to take a certain Joseph as long as the price was good enough that they could make a profit. So traders and trading caravans all over the place. Yes. Is looking up sea cow.
Well, it's very large, also called stellar sea cow, very large aquatic mammal now extinct.
Oh.
Which once inhabited near shore areas of the Comodore Islands in the Bering Sea. Stellar sea cows were wiped out by hunters in the 18th century, less than 30 years after they were first discovered.
Well, but that does not, that doesn't give us a settled name for something in the second millennium BC.
Also, sometimes refers to manatees or dugong. Dugong.
Yeah, that was in my footnotes, dugong, but I don't know what that is.
A marine mammal inhabiting warm coastal waters of the Indian and Pacific Oceans that feeds on seagrasses, similar to the American manatee.
Okay.
Oh.
Yeah, I do remember the dugong in the commentaries.
They are in the Red Sea and the Persian Gulf.
Okay. But they would provide the waterproofing in case you had a rainstorm while everything was being transported. And they were used in the construction of the fabrics over the whole assembly.
Yeah. I don't know if you can see that, but that's what they look like.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Okay, then.
Look like a seal.
Verse 7. And over the table of the bread of the presence, they shall spread a cloth of blue and put on it the plates and the dishes for incense, the bowls and the flagons for the drink offering. The regular showbread also shall be on it. Verse 8.
Over these, they are to spread a scarlet cloth, cover that with hides of sea cows and put it in its poles in place.
Yep.
Does the blue signify something?
That's actually a tougher question than, because if you look up the history of colors, you find out that certain colors were very difficult to make in dyeing of fabrics. And so you get a confusion between purple and scarlet and blue. A number of the colors that we take for granted were just not available for making cloth in those colors. So symbolically, blue, scarlet, purple, especially blue and purple, symbolic of royalty, scarlet, symbolic of royalty. What was the color of the robe they put back on Christ after they whipped him? Scarlet or purple? We don't know. The color names are ambiguous still in that time. So if you want to, I can dig out my research on that and go into it next time. We've got packages coming, Paula.
Well, I just wondered, since they're being so
stopped in front and walking stuff up.
So we'll see everybody.
I just, since they're being so specific about the color of the coverings, I just wondered if it had a
meaning. Certainly it does. And sometimes blue is for the sky, scarlet for blood, purple for royalty. And that's generally the thing you go with. But then again, what are the Hebrew names for those colors? Are we sure that they're translated absolutely accurately? No, we're not. Just a little bit of, these are our limitations.
Okay.
Let's see. And they shall take a cloth of blue and cover the lampstand for the light with its lamps, its tongs, its trays, and all the vessels for oil with which it is supplied. Verse 10.
And they shall put it with all its utensils and a covering of goatskin and put it on the carrion frame.
Yep. Goatskin or sea cow or dugong or...
Yeah, mine kept saying goatskin.
Yeah, so's mine. I don't know how waterproof goatskin is. But, you know, these are the limits of the translations.
If we could, the NIV is saying sea cows and everything.
Yeah, if we could go back and ask them.
Yeah.
Verse 11, let's see. And over the golden altar, they shall spread a cloth of blue and cover it with a covering of
whatever. Some kind of skin.
And shall put in it its poles. Verse 12.
And they shall take all the vessels of the service that are used in the sanctuary and put them in a cloth of blue and cover them with a covering of goatskin and put them on the carrying frame.
And they shall take away the ashes from the altar and spread a purple cloth over it. Verse 14.
And they are to place on it all the utensils used for ministering at the altar, including the fire pans, meat forks, shovels and sprinkling bowls. Over it, they are to spread a covering of hides of sea cows and put its poles in place.
And when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, as the camp sets out, after that, the sons of Kohath shall come to carry these, but they must not touch the holy things, lest they die. These are the things of the tent of meeting that the sons of Kohath are to carry. Verse 16.
Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest, is to have charge of the oil for the light, the fragrant incense, the regular grain offering, and the anointing oil. He is to be in charge of the entire tabernacle, mm-hmm. and everything in it, including its holy furnishings and articles.
Okay. So far, the Kohathites. Verse 17, the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying, verse 18.
See that the Kohathite tribe clans are not cut off from the Levites.
Mm-hmm. But deal thus with them that they may live and not die when they come near to the most holy things. Aaron and his son shall go in and appoint them each to his task and to his burden. Verse 20.
But they shall not go in to look on the holy things even for a moment, lest they die.
Okay. And there is that restriction against intruding. And it's a very powerful thing. Not only can you not see the face of the Lord and live, but you can't look on the things of the tabernacle. Okay. Moving on to another tribe. To another division. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 22,
Take a census of the sons of Gershon also by their father's house and by their clans.
Mm-hmm. From 30 years old and up to 50 years old, you shall list them all who can come to do duty, to do service in the tent of meeting. Verse 24.
This is the service of the Gershonite clans as they work and carry burdens.
They shall carry the curtains of the tabernacle and the tent of meeting with its covering and the covering of whatever skins that is on top of it. And those same skins were used over the whole assembly in order to provide waterproofing. And the screen for the entrance of the tent of meeting. Verse 26.
And the hanging goes the and the hangings of the court and the screen for the entrance of the gate of the court that is around the tabernacle and the altar and their cords and all the equipment for their service. And they shall do all that needs to be done with regard to them.
Mm-hmm. All the service of the sons of the Gershonites shall be at the command of Aaron and his sons in all that they are to carry and in all that they have to do. And you shall assign to their charge all that they are to carry. Verse 28.
This is the service of the clans of the sons of the Gershonites in the tent of meeting, and their guard duty is to be under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest.
Okay. And we've got one more division to go. These are the heavier parts of the structure. As for the sons of Merari, you shall list them by their clans and their father's houses. Verse 30.
Count all the men from 30 to 50 years of age who come to serve in the work at the tent of meeting.
And this is what they are charged to carry. As the whole of their service in the tent of meeting, the frames of the tabernacle with its bars, pillars, and bases. 32.
And the pillars around the court with their bases, pegs, and cords, with all their equipment and all their accessories, and you shall list by name the objects that they are required to carry.
This is the service of the clans of the sons of Merari, the whole of their service in the tent of meeting, under the direction of Ithamar, the son of Aaron, the priest. Okay, verse 34.
Moses, Aaron, and the leaders of the community counted the Kohathites by their clans and families.
Mm-hmm. From 30 years old up to 50 years old, everyone who could come on duty for service in the tent of meeting, verse 36.
And those listed by clans were 2,750.
This was the list of the clans of the Kohathites, all who served in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron listed according to the commandment of the Lord by Moses. 38.
The Gershonites were counted by their clans and families.
From 30 years old up to 50 years old, everyone who could come on duty for service in the tent of meeting. Verse 40.
Those listed by their clans and their fathers' houses were 2,630.
This was the list of the clans of the sons of Gershon, all who served in the tent of meeting, whom Moses and Aaron listed according to the commandment of the Lord. Verse 42.
Those listed of the clans of the house of Merari by their clans and their father's houses.
From 30 years old up to 50 years told everyone who could come on duty for service in the tent of meeting. Verse 44.
Those listed by clans were 3,200.
This was the list of the clans of the sons of Merari, whom Moses and Aaron listed according to the commandment of the Lord by Moses. 46.
So Moses, Aaron, and the leaders of Israel counted all the Levites by their clans and families.
Mm-hmm. From 30 years old up to 50 years old, everyone who could come to do the service of the ministry and the service of bearing burdens in the tent of meeting.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Mine say all the men, but yours says everyone. Was that just understood that it was the men, or did they mean women too?
No, that was understood to be the men.
Okay.
Yeah. So verse 48.
Those listed were 8,580.
That was a short verse. Mm-hmm. According to the commandment of the Lord through Moses, they were listed, each one with his task of serving or carrying. Thus they were listed by him as the Lord commanded Moses. And you would have, outside of the Bible, huge amount of paper used for tallying and listing and all kinds of things. Keeping the census, keeping the record of who is descended from whom, and on and on and on. We did not need that to be included in the Bible, because that would have probably doubled the size of the Bible. But now we are to chapter 5, and certain things are done in chapter 5 to be of a purifying nature, and then something that isn't what it appears like to us. Verse 1, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2,
command the Israelites to send away from the camp anyone who has an infectious skin disease or a discharge of any kind, or who is ceremonial unclean because of a dead body.
Okay.
Ceremonially, sorry.
Yeah, and this would be only for a while. It would be on the outskirts, and then after a period of cleansing would be admitted back in. But you shall put out both male and female, putting them outside the camp that they may not defile their camp in the midst of which I dwell. Because God has a standard that is absolute purity. And since Adam and Eve did what they did, there's all kinds of impurity running around among us. And that's just the facts of it. We don't like to think of ourselves as unclean, but in his eyes, yes.
Are
you? So verse 4.
And the people of Israel did so and put them outside the camp, as the Lord said to Moses. So the people of Israel did.
Okay. So they did this purifying. Okay. Then verse 5. The Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 6.
Say to the Israelites, when a man or woman wrongs another in any way, and so is unfaithful to the Lord, that person is guilty.
Mm-hmm. And that person realizes his guilt. He'd have to realize it in order to, verse 7. He shall confess his sin that he has committed, and he shall make full restitution for his wrong, adding a fifth to it and giving it to him whom he did the wrong, to whom he did the wrong.
Oh, okay.
And that has to do with sins against property and your neighbor's earnings, etc. Verse 8.
But if the man has no next of kin to whom restitution may be made for the wrong, the restitution for wrong shall go to the Lord for the priest in addition to the ram of atonement with which atonement is made for him.
And assumed in that verse then is what happens if you did wrong to your neighbor and your neighbor died? How do you make restitution? Delitzsch mentions the term the goel, the next of kin. And restitution would be made to the next of kin. But if there is no next of kin, what then? And that's what verse 8 covers. Verse 9, and every contribution, all the holy donations of the people of Israel, which they bring to the priest, shall be his.
Well, at least you got a decent job now. So, how much?
And,
oh, wow. You got a raise.
Okay. Next verse, verse 10.
Each one shall keep his holy donations. Whatever anyone gives to the priest shall be his.
Okay.
If you're there long enough, why?
The next section, a test for adultery, is not what it looks like. What it looks like is a trial or a passing through a testing that many nations around did. And one of the tests was, one of the absurd tests was, if she floats, she's a witch.
Mm-hmm.
Trial by ordeal. Okay, this is not. That has to be said heading into this. Secondly, there are certain things that are done in different areas of the world where if a person is guilty, then even if the trial by ordeal feeds on the feelings of guilt so that the feelings of guilt cause the consequences that they are threatening. And again, this is not. It has to be read pretty carefully to sort out and separate out what is actually going on. So we dig into it. Verse 11, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, verse 12.
Speak to the people of Israel. If any man's wife goes astray and breaks faith with him.
Okay. God has first claim on any offense that is done. Verse 13, if a man lies with her sexually and it is hidden from the eyes of her husband, and she is undetected, though she has defiled herself, and there is no witness against her, since she was not taken in the act. That's one possibility. Verse 14.
And if the feelings of jealousy come over her husband, and he suspects his wife, and she is impure, or if he is jealous and suspects her, even though she is not impure.
Okay, so the full range of what that covers is she did it and her husband begins to suspect, or she did it and her husband knows, or she didn't do it and her husband
is paranoid.
The suspicious kind. I can sort all of that out. And the reason why this becomes important is Well, basically, what is the basic building block of a society? It is the family. And if the family is disrupted, the whole society suffers. And if the people are going to be the people of God, then does God have an interest in making sure that the marriage bonds, those held honorably, are undisturbed and preserved in honor? Of course he does. So with that in mind, setting the tone, that's very important to set the tone so that we go forward seeing it in that light. So going forward, then, in any of those cases, then the man shall bring his wife to the priest and bring the offering required of her, a tenth of an ephah of barley flour. He shall pour no oil on it and put no frankincense on it, for it is a grain offering of jealousy, a grain offering of remembrance, bringing iniquity to remembrance. So because the accusation hangs there, it is not to be accepted as an offering with oil, symbolic of the Holy Spirit, and incense, symbolic of prayer, and specifically of the interceding prayers of Christ. And it's one of these other things. And it is brought as an offering to ask God to sort everything out. Verse 16.
And the priest shall bring her near and set her before the Lord.
Mm-hmm. And the priest shall take holy water. What? There's such a thing? Okay. And the priest shall take holy water in an earthenware vessel and take some of the dust that is on the floor of the tabernacle and put it into the water. Several points to explain. The water would be taken from the basin that was there for the washing for purification. And that would be put in an earthenware vessel because there's the possibility of sin being involved, and so the earthenware vessel would be destroyed later on. And dust from the floor of the tabernacle, sprinkle some dust on it. Why? Is this trial by ordeal? No, it is God taking of the holy things of his tabernacle and directing that be mixed in. So the holiness of God called as a witness and as what will judge the guilt or the innocence. Verse 18.
After the priest has had the woman stand before the Lord, he shall loosen her hair and place in her hands the reminder offering, the grain offering for jealousy, while he himself holds the bitter water that brings a curse.
Okay. Well, brings a curse or doesn't bring a curse, depending on the judgment of God. The unbinding of the hair is for that moment, she is not under any authority other than God's. She is not in the marriage bond that's become questionable, that will either be reaffirmed or it will be declared to have been broken. Verse 19, Then the priest shall make her take an oath, saying, if no man has lain with you, and if you have not turned aside to uncleanness while you were under your husband's authority, be free from this water of bitterness that brings the curse. Verse 20.
What's the water of bitterness?
Well, that is the water of the holy water, water taken from the basin for purification with some of the dust of the tabernacle sprinkled on it.
Okay.
And it's called the water of bitterness because there is the potentiality of it bringing a curse. Besides which, if she's perfectly innocent, how's she feeling? Bitter toward her husband. That's all going on there. The jealousy and the bitterness and everything else is breaking up the bonds of this marriage and family, and becomes part of the things that are a threat to the peace and the well-orderedness of the nation. So, let's see. Verse 20.
But if you've gone astray while married to your husband, and you have defiled yourself by sleeping with a man other than your husband,
mm-hmm, then let the priest make the woman take the oath of the curse and say to the woman, the Lord make you a curse and an oath among your people when the Lord makes your thigh fall away and your body swell. Gotta read verse 22 before any questions.
May this water that brings the curse pass into your bowels and make your womb swell and your thigh fall away. And the woman shall say, amen, amen.
Okay. And Galich and others speculate as to what condition or state this would be in, the womb swell, the thigh fall away. Not pleasant. There are certain medical conditions that can fit that description. But the woman affirms, and by taking the oath, she is saying before God, I have not done this, and if I have done this, let the curse of God come upon me. At which point, some would say, well, by doing that, it's an ordeal by her own sense of innocence or guilt. And if she's guilty, the stress of living with swearing falsely will cause her medical problems, and on and on and on. That is not what this is. And that needs to be part of what we continue to say. This is not what the other nations around them were doing. So verse 23. Then the priest shall write these curses in a book and wash them off into the water of bitterness. Really?
She has to drink her words.
Yeah. What are we as human beings? We are those who have received our life through the word of God, through the actions of God, and who have received our blessings through the words of the blessings back in Genesis chapter 1. Our entire life is bound up in these things called words. That's the stuff of the soul. Okay, verse 24.
And he shall make the woman drink the water of bitterness that brings the curse, and the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain.
Maybe.
Maybe.
maybe. And the priest shall take the grain offering of jealousy out of the woman's hand and shall wave the grain offering before the Lord and bring it to the altar. Verse 26.
And the priest shall take a handful of the grain offering as its memorial portion and burn it on the altar, and afterwards shall make the woman drink the water.
Mm-hmm. And when he has made her drink the water, then if she has defiled herself and has broken faith with her husband, the water that brings the curse shall enter into her and cause bitter pain, and her womb shall swell, and her thigh shall fall away, and the woman shall become a curse among her people. Verse 28.
If, however, the woman has not defiled herself and is free from impurity, she will be cleared of guilt and will be able to have children.
Okay. And you may ask, why is it that the negative part is gone into in such detail, and then it's very short with, but if she has not? The reason, you know, Dalich says the reason why is because it provides an incentive to not do those things. Yes, it's my phone. They'll call back if it's important.
Yeah, but if she's, does she have to, she has to drink all this water and stuff, even if she's innocent?
Well, how much water? You know, it doesn't specify volume.
I'd take the cup and whack my husband on the head with it if I was accused of something I didn't do and had to go through all that.
Okay, so the question, drinking a cup of water that has a little bit of dust in it, is that going to cause a deadly curse?
Well, yeah, that's true.
And normally the answer would be absolutely not. That wouldn't happen. So under normal circumstances with somebody who's innocent and you drink it and nothing happens, then your innocence is proven and you can say to the priest, can I take this cup so I can break it over the head of my husband? And the priest may say, yeah, go ahead. Especially if he's been there before.
Well, yeah.
Yeah.
What do they do for the cheating husbands?
That's what I'm thinking. I'm glad I'm not the only one who's thinking that.
The cheating husband was to be put to death also.
Well, why is it not spelled out here?
Mm-hmm.
It is spelled out elsewhere.
Oh, yeah, when it comes.
But this is the trial to, you know, switch how the thing sounds and say, this is the trial to prove her innocence.
So I guess my question is, I don't understand the whole drink this and something bad's going to happen. Did sometimes God do something to make something bad happen when they drank it?
Well, we're not told those details, but this is in the first five books of the Bible, and there were those that were guilty who were called out by God. And well, in the sixth book of the Bible, there is Achan, who just took a little something from Jericho. That didn't pass. There were those who broke the Sabbath, one guy that broke the Sabbath, and he was called out and died. So there are these isolated incidences, and the people had seen all of this activity of God. Do you suppose the evidences of the ongoing miracles might have kept a bunch of them in line?
I mean, they knew the miracles when they were wandering around in the desert, and they still complain.
And many of them died.
I just think, like, if nothing ever happened, It's like the parent who's always threatening the child. And eventually the kid knows that nothing's actually going to happen. So big deal.
But well, in my footnotes, it says that it caused her to have a miscarrying womb and barrenness.
But the whole thing is, this is the dust from the floor of the tabernacle, that the Kohathites aren't even supposed to touch the things of the holy things of God. And so it does not depend on the power of the dust.
Right. It's God.
It is God.
It's his and word.
He
says, I will sort this out.
Well, you can tell God's not a movie maker when he wrote this, because a movie maker would be striking one down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And about those details, we don't know. But for the wife who is innocent,
It must have happened over a certain length of time, though, not immediately, this curse or not a curse, because if it has to do with barrenness or a miscarrying womb, or if the woman was innocent, she was able to have children. So it must have, they must not have had an immediate answer to this test.
Okay, I'm trying to find the okay. Michaelis supposes it to be dropsy of the ovary, which would be a tumor forming in the ovary, swelling it so as to pulls in fluid. And with that, the patient becomes dreadfully emaciated. Josephus says ordinary dropsy. Theodoret, the punishment shall come from the same source as the sin. So the accumulation of fluid in a tumor or cyst that becomes massive is what is on the minds of the commentators.
And I can get that. I mean, if she had an illicit affair and it wasn't caught and it was all in secret, mm-hmm. God is like, you're going to do it in secret, I'll do this. It's all in secret inside, because there's nowhere you can go to hide from God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's all about his word, because how does baptism work except it's just plain water, but it's the word mixed with the elements.
Oh, yes. So and you brought to mind a thought that I had reading through this. Baptism is water connected with the word that provides a blessing. This is water combined with dust from the floor of the tabernacle.
With the word.
Does the things of the word, carries the power of the word of God. Whether for blessing or for curse. Was the fruit of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, was it poison? No. It had no power in and of itself. Its power came from the word that God attached to it. So it's always the word. And that gives a very good correction for thinking in ordinary ways or in terms of trial by ordeal. It is the word of God. And we're almost to the end of chapter 5, which I'd love to finish. This is the law in cases of jealousy. When a wife, though under her husband's authority, goes astray and defiles herself, verse 30,
or when the spirit of jealousy comes over a man and he is jealous of his wife, then he shall set the woman before the Lord, and the priest shall carry out for her all this law.
Okay. If she's guilty, then verse 31, the man shall be free from iniquity, but the woman shall bear her iniquity. And you know how men can be. God provides this as a safeguard, in one sense, for the woman. Chapter 6 enters into the Nazirite vow. We still have 6, 7, 8, and 9, where they're still at Sinai, have not left yet. So chapter 6, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, verse 2,
Speak to the Israelites and say to them, if a man or woman wants to make a special vow, a vow of separation to the Lord as a Nazirite.
Okay. So we're going to study what makes up a Nazirite and a Nazirite vow. Verse 3, he shall separate himself from wine and strong drink. He shall drink no vinegar made from wine or strong drink, and shall not drink any juice of grapes or eat grapes fresh or dried. Verse 4.
All the days of his separation, he shall eat nothing that is produced by the grapevine, not even the seeds or the skins.
Okay. So, yeah. All the days of his vow of separation, no razor shall touch his head until the time is completed for which he separates himself to the Lord. He shall be holy. He shall let the locks of hair of his head grow long. You might remember that Paul, during his third missionary journey, was under a vow and had to go up to Jerusalem to offer his hair. And this was a part of it. Verse 6.
All the days that he separates himself to the Lord, he shall not go near a dead body.
Mm-hmm. Not even for his father or his mother or for brother or sister, if they die, shall he make himself unclean, because his separation to God is on his head. Verse 8.
All the days of his separation, he is holy to the Lord.
Now remember, the Old Testament definition of holy is separated for God's use. It's more complicated. And if any man dies very suddenly beside him, and he defiles his consecrated head, then he shall shave his head on the day of his cleansing. On the seventh day, he shall shave it. Verse 10.
What is the separation for? Is he becoming a priest or something, or?
And Delitzsch does go into that somewhat and says, this is aside from service in the tabernacle or temple or anything else that the priests did, set aside the service part of it, but it is somewhat of the lifestyle of the priest.
Like a monk or something like that?
Well, a monk is a Roman Catholic Middle Ages construct.
Right, but I mean something like that, where they separate themselves from everybody. And
They would have built the idea of monks and monasteries on top of this. But
the study Bible says it was an exercise or a declaration of faith before the people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So to live without a number of the nice things of life. But going on, did we do verse 10?
No.
Okay, verse 10.
On the eighth day, he shall bring two turtle doves or two pigeons to the priest to the entrance of the tent of meeting.
Yeah. Wait for the other shoe to drop. Wait for it to drop. And the priest shall offer one for a sin offering and the other for a burnt offering. Burnt offering is for sanctification and dedication to God. And make atonement for him because he sinned by reason of the dead body. And he shall consecrate his head that same day. Verse 12, here it comes.
And separate himself to the Lord for the days of his separation, and bring a male lamb a year old for a guilt offering. But the previous period shall be void because his separation was defiled.
So he has to start all over again.
So even though this was by accident that he was next to a dead person.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you take the Nazarite vow on January 1st for the entire year. On December 30th, somebody dies right next to you.
Yeah, do it again.
The God? Someone dies right next to you?
Yeah.
So why is God punishing this man?
Is it punishment or is God saying, yeah, days of separation for the service of God. I like it. Let's do it again.
Yeah.
So you won't be done until after January 1st, the year after.
Unless somebody dies again.
Exactly. So watch how many days you vow for.
Right.
Go into coronavirus seclusion to keep yourself away from people.
And this is the law for the Nazarite when the time of his separation has been completed. He shall be brought to the entrance of the tent of meeting, verse 14.
And there he is to present his offerings to the Lord. A year-old male lamb without defect for a burnt offering, a year-old ewe lamb without defect for a sin offering, a ram without defect for a fellowship offering.
And a basket of unleavened bread, loaves of fine flour mixed with oil, and unleavened wafers smeared with oil, and their grain offering and their drink offerings. Verse 16.
And the priest shall bring them before the Lord and offer his sin offering and his burnt offering.
Okay. And he shall offer the ram as a sacrifice of peace offering to the Lord with the basket of unleavened bread. The priest shall offer also its grain offering and its drink offering. Verse 18.
And the Nazarite shall shave his consecrated head at the entrance of the tent of meeting, and shall take the hair from his consecrated head and put it on the fire that is under the sacrifice of the peace offering. Ooh, that'll stink.
And it'll burn up quick. And the priest shall take the shoulder of the ram when it is boiled, and one unleavened loaf out of the basket, and one unleavened wafer, and shall put them on the hands of the Nazarite after he has shaved the hair of his consecration. Verse 20.
The priest shall wave them before the Lord as a wave offering. They are holy and belong to the priest, together with the breast that was waved and the thigh that was presented. After that, the Nazarite may drink wine.
Yay! So what are among the things that are there at the completion of this? Bread and wine. Hmm. Mm-hmm. And a lamb. This is the law of the Nazarite But if he vows an offering to the Lord above his Nazirite vow, as he can afford, in exact accordance with the vow that he takes, then he shall do in addition to the law of the Nazirite. There became a practice later on in Israel as this went on of sponsors for a Nazirite vow, where the added two might be contributed by somebody else. And I don't know any more about that. It was just mentioned in passing by Delitzsch. And that brings us to the Aaronic benediction.
Well, the Nazirite, was that just another, well, I'm not quite sure of understanding why this just applies to the Nazirite?
Mm-hmm. It was a voluntary vow that the person could do kind of on his own initiative for a period of devotion to God. And as the Nazirite wanted to do that, it was of his own volition. There was a little bit of some religious spontaneity. It was not required, but was, I want to do something special for a time of dedication to God. What did they call Jesus? He shall be called the
Nazarene.
And Nazarene, Nazirite, Nazareth, all three have the same root word, Nazar, meaning separation. And so there is a bleeding over from one to the other. The categories are not kept entirely separate from each other. The Nazirite vows varied through the years. For example, Samson was a Nazirite. The hair of his head, but did he drink strong drink? Yes, he did. He would get drunk. And yet that fit within the Nazirite vow. There is a variation in what constitutes a Nazirite. The definition shifts a little bit. The borders around it are not completely solid. Did Jesus drink wine?
Yes.
Yeah. Now they called John the Baptist one name because he didn't, and Jesus another name because he did. And John the Baptist was a Nazirite. Jesus was called a Nazirite. And later on, he became known as the Nazarene. But the understanding, because of the root word, the whole idea runs through the whole thing, separated for God's service.
So I assume that the religions, the Nazarenes of today, got their name from this?
They named themselves after Jesus being called a Nazarene. Mm-hmm. And taking up the theme from this is a part of their self-identification, their understanding of their religious practices. Yeah. It's one of those two. The thing with a Nazirite, stay aware of it, because it comes up every so often through the Old Testament. And if you have the basics from this, you can refer back to it. You can notice the differences and notice what is special about the life of the Nazirite. All that makes sense? Hey, let's finish there and pick up next time with the Aaronic benediction. We should have one more session before leaving Sinai.